Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.6, The Iron Ladle, Armenian Resistance, Part 1. The unification of Bulgaria with Eastern Rumelia in 1885 was the culmination of a near decade-long process in which the lands of the Ottoman Empire were fundamentally transformed. When you compare Ottoman lands between the year 1875, when Slavic nationalist uprisings began to erupt amongst the Christians of the Balkans, to the year 1885, when the Bulgarians successfully annexed Eastern Rumelia, the loss of territory for the Ottomans is truly immense. The Ottoman Empire had gone from being a transcontinental superpower with extensive domains in North Africa, the Middle East, Anatolia, and much of Southern Europe, to being a mere regional power of Western Asia. Now, the Ottomans would still cling desperately to their historic claim of ruling an empire stretching across three continents, but their African and European territories were becoming ever more tenuously held, as evidenced by their recent losses to Bulgaria, which cut European Thrace right in half, and their loss of Egypt to the British and Tunisia to the French. Then, of course, these more recent losses were only an aftershock following the true earthquake that was the disastrous defeat dealt out by Russia in 1878. The war with Russia and the nationalist uprisings that had brought it about had shaken the empire to its foundations and left it a shell of its former self. But there was yet one more humiliating piece of the 1878 Treaty of Berlin that we have mentioned in passing but not yet fully discussed. And that piece is Eastern Anatolia. Because the 1878 Russian invasion had not only come through the Ottoman Balkans, but had also come through the Caucasus and into Eastern Anatolia. And at the same time that the Russian army was ominously waiting outside the gates of Constantinople, there had been yet another force farther to the east, occupying large swaths of the Anatolian Peninsula. And as part of the final settlement at the Congress of Berlin, the Russians were allowed to annex the three territories of Kars, Ardahan, and Batum, carving out a large chunk of territory where the Black Sea meets the northeastern edge of Anatolia, right along the southern foothills of the Caucasus. See the maps at 20thCenturyRevolutions.com. This territory on the border of eastern Anatolia and the southern Caucasus was actually some of the only territory that the Russians were able to annex outright. This was mainly due to the fact that the conquered regions of the Balkans had ended up being carved into independent or autonomous states. And even though the territorial settlement in the Caucasus and in Anatolia was seen by Western diplomats as not quite as important as that in the Balkans, the annexation of Kars, Ardahan, and Batum was of major symbolic importance within the larger centuries-old conflict between the Ottoman and Russian empires. Because while the Russians had been peeling off Ottoman territory in the Caucasus little by little for many years, the taking of these three provinces represented the arrival of the Russians into Anatolia, into the Ottoman heartland. And this fact is why these three Russian-annexed territories will come to be seen as essentially an Ottoman Alsace-Lorraine, a stolen territory right on the border of an enemy empire, always reminding the Ottomans of all they had lost during the 1877 war. And so, the loss of these territories was just one more humiliation for the Ottomans to add to their very long list of humiliations coming out of the settlement at the Congress of Berlin. And I'll say it one more time. We cannot overstate the impact of these territorial losses between 1878 and 1885 on the general psyche of Ottoman statesmen. Because heading into the 20th century, there will be this ever-present feeling of having been pushed into a corner, as the wolves of European imperialism and the jackals of revolutionary nationalism were hungrily eyeing the Ottomans, just waiting for the next little sign of weakness where they could pounce and pry even more territory away from them. And now that the empire had largely been whittled down to its core in Anatolia, the Middle East, and the Southern Balkans, Sultan Abdulhamid and his government would cling desperately to the territory that they did have left, and they would respond brutally to any threats, real or perceived, to these remaining lands. This paranoid fear amongst Ottoman leaders of losing yet more territory to the combined forces of European imperialism and revolutionary nationalism would lead to some pretty terrible consequences for the people living in the regions still under threat of great power intervention, specifically Macedonia and Eastern Anatolia. Because the fate of these two provinces had been left very unresolved at the Congress of Berlin. And as we know from our last couple of episodes on the Bulgarians, the Berlin settlement only further inflamed all of the competing claims over Ottoman Macedonia. So tensions in Macedonia will continue to just bubble, 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 and then occasionally explode over the next several decades. But we will come back to Macedonia, because today we are turning our attention eastward to the other area left so unresolved at the Congress of Berlin, Eastern Anatolia, or as it was referred to at the Congress, the six Armenian provinces. And as we just mentioned, the Russians annexed the three territories of Kars, Ardahan, and Batum, and these three territories would hold a special symbolic significance as the centuries-long Russian conquest of Ottoman lands had finally reached the Anatolian doorstep. But along with being symbolically important, these three territories were also demographically important due to their large population of Armenians. So, in eastern Anatolia, right alongside these recently annexed Russian territories, were six Ottoman provinces that were all home to significant populations of Armenians. These were the six Armenian provinces, or the six vilayets. And at the Congress of Berlin, there was much discussion amongst the great powers over what to do about these six Armenian provinces. But what made this all extremely complicated is that although Armenians did at times make up the largest single ethnic group in these areas, the regions were not necessarily majority Christian, as was the case in places like Bulgaria or Serbia. Instead, there were large populations of both Turks and Kurds, who were separate ethnic groups, yes, but who were both Muslim, and taken together, the Turks and the Kurds usually made these provinces majority Muslim, or at the very least made it split right down the middle between Christian and Muslim. And so with these tricky demographics, the Armenians were not granted their requested autonomy over these regions. But within the context of the Congress of Berlin, where the great powers were just popping out new Christian nation-states left and right, the Armenians, as a very historically significant Christian community within the Ottoman Empire, were very clearly being left out. And this fact is what led the great powers to demand the Ottomans reform the six Armenian provinces and then update them down the road on the progress of these reforms, with the assumption being that the great powers would intervene on behalf of the Armenians should they feel that they were being mistreated by the Ottomans. So much like Macedonia, eastern Anatolia would become a hotly contested area in the coming decades, with fierce tension always bubbling underneath the surface and with sporadic and at times horrific violence just a moment away from bursting forth. And to really understand why this region will become a focal point of ethno-religious tension and violence in the empire, we need to wind the clock back quite a bit. Because the land that the Ottomans referred to as Eastern Anatolia was a very ancient place full of very ancient peoples. And the territory was just as often referred to as Western Armenia, or Kurdistan. Because the Armenians and the Kurds had cohabitated this rough mountainous highland, known for its extreme climate and difficult terrain, long before the Ottomans, or even Turkic people generally, had ever even stepped foot in eastern Anatolia. By the time the Ottomans rolled around, there had been people in eastern Anatolia speaking some form of Proto-Armenian and loosely calling themselves Armenians for thousands of years. We're talking like Herodotus and Darius the Great mentioning the Armenians. But as is the case with many ancient civilizations, these Proto-Armenians were definitely not some unified nation, but were rather a scattered mix of rural peasants and herdsmen, loosely governed by a collection of princes, who were very often at war with each other, but who still all more or less shared a common Armenian language and culture. And then if we speed things along quite a bit and make it to around the 4th century AD, we reach a very important moment when the Armenians became some of the very first people to adopt Christianity. Now, I am not going to get into the weeds of the long, confusing history of the Armenian Church, but just know that the Armenian Apostolic Church is one of the most ancient Christian institutions, like ever. Many claim that the Kingdom of Armenia was literally the very first state in the world to adopt Christianity as its official religion at the turn of the 4th century. Now, yes, the Ethiopian Church also claims this mantle, but you know, we're really splitting hairs here. They're both really old, you guys. And to give you some context, the Kingdom of Armenia adopted Christianity just a few years before the Roman Emperor Constantine was himself starting to play around with the idea of maybe converting to Christianity. So yeah, the connection between the Armenians and Christianity goes way back. And from this point on, the most defining feature of the Armenians will be their unique brand of Christianity. Once Emperor Constantine did go ahead and kick off the process of Christianizing the Roman Empire, the Armenian Apostolic Church and the Byzantine Eastern Orthodox Church would come to view each other as heretical. So, the Armenian Church was actually not allowed to operate in Constantinople during the Roman Byzantine period. But when Mehmed the Conqueror took Constantinople for the Ottomans in 1453, the Ottomans would allow for the establishment of an Armenian patriarchate that would operate alongside the already existing Greek Orthodox patriarchate. So what this meant is that unlike the Bulgarians, whom you may remember had for centuries worshipped under the umbrella of the Greek Orthodox Church, the Armenians would have their own patriarchate, legally separate and equal in status to the Greek patriarchate, ever since the original Ottoman conquest. And this is one of those surprising ironies of Ottoman rule, namely that Mehmed's conquest of Constantinople led to the official recognition of the Armenian Apostolic Church, a recognition that had long been denied by the Orthodox Byzantines. So, starting around 1400 or so, Eastern Anatolia came under the Ottoman imperial umbrella, and this control would be further solidified with the successive conquests of Mehmed the Conqueror, Selim the Grim, and Suleiman the Magnificent. But even though Ottoman lands now extended well beyond eastern Anatolia into Mesopotamia, the Caucasus, and the Arabian Holy Lands, the land inhabited by the Armenians would be one of those regions of the Ottoman Empire that was never really fully conquered. This had a lot to do with the very difficult terrain of eastern Anatolia, which was dotted by giant impassable mountains and which fluctuated between cold, bitter winters and oppressively hot summers. So for hundreds of years, Ottoman administrators allowed the people of eastern Anatolia to largely govern their own affairs, mostly just sending in tax collectors to gather the imperial tribute. And so, many Armenian communities were allowed a significant degree of autonomy, and the Armenian Church Patriarchate would come to act as the main point of contact between the Sultan's administrators and the Armenians of Eastern Anatolia. This autonomy would allow the Armenians to maintain their distinctive culture and religion throughout the Ottoman period. And now, we will turn our attention to the other group of people who had long inhabited this region, and who would similarly hold on to their unique traditions and culture long after the Ottoman conquest. And that is the Kurds. Now, the history of the Kurds is kind of hard to nail down, because while the Armenians are one of those rare groups, like the Greeks or the Chinese, who have a literary canon stretching way back into the dark mists of time, the Kurds had long been a nomadic people without much in the way of a written culture, and some even trace the origin of the name Kurd to the Persian and Arabic words for nomadic tent dweller. Of course, all of these theories are still hotly debated, but no matter where the ethnic label originally came from, the name Kurd was long associated with the nomadic tribal societies of eastern Anatolia. Much like the Armenians, there was not some homogeneous culture of the Kurds running back into ancient times, but rather there had long existed in this region many different nomadic tribes who shared a common language, albeit with countless dialects, and who would occasionally unite to achieve common goals. So tribal confederations of Kurdish-speaking people would every now and then come together to fight off a common enemy. Though just as often, Kurdish tribes would ally themselves with outside forces in order to defeat other Kurdish tribes, who were more often than not their rivals. Starting in the 600s AD, the great Islamic conquests of the Middle East would sweep through much of southern Kurdistan. And as a result of these conquests, many Kurds converted to Islam, either through forced conversions at the hands of conquering Arab armies, or through a desire to assimilate into the newly dominant religion. So by the time the Turkic tribes of Central Asia, the ancestors of Ottoman rulers, were moving into Anatolia and beginning to challenge the far eastern border of the Roman Byzantine Empire, the majority of nomadic Kurds inhabiting this region were already practicing Islam. And then, after the fall of Constantinople and the subsequent Ottoman conquests, round about the 1500s, the Ottomans would try to bring eastern Anatolia under their imperial control. And this meant that they would try to incorporate both the Kurds and the Armenians into the Ottoman imperial system. As we know, the Ottomans were masters at folding local leaders into the Ottoman system, mainly through allowing these local leaders to retain a certain level of autonomous control over their local community, while still demanding a tribute of money, resources, and people. And what this meant in practice is that the Armenian Church Patriarchate would become a very powerful institution, both in Constantinople and in eastern Anatolia. And then for the Kurds, local tribal leaders were granted a high level of autonomy and would rule as Ottoman beys, which was basically just a more official title given to local chieftains. So, what the Ottoman style of decentralized imperial rule led to in eastern Anatolia specifically was that powerful tribal leaders, who were as a rule Muslim, usually Kurdish or Turkic, established little fiefdoms within a kind of pseudo-feudal society. On the top of the pyramid were these powerful Muslim beys, essentially lords, who would rule over a large population of peasants. And most of these peasants were Christian Armenians, though many of them were also Turkish Muslims. Now, this specific arrangement grew out of the fact that the Ottoman millet system heavily favored Muslims, and even though there were many powerful Christians, specifically Armenians and Greeks, who served within the imperial administration over in Constantinople, out in the borderlands of the empire, in areas like eastern Anatolia, the vast majority of Christians were a part of the so-called raya, which just means the flock, and in practice referred to rural peasants. So even though there were also many Muslim peasants, as a general rule, Muslim Kurdish landlords ruled over Christian Armenian peasants in eastern Anatolia. Now, there is another very specific dynamic that would emerge in Kurdish-Armenian relations during the Ottoman period. Those Kurds who were not able to become powerful feudal landlords, so, you know, like the majority of the Kurds, continued to live as tribal nomads. So for the most part, Kurds lived up in the mountains as nomads, and Armenians lived either down in the plains as peasants or in the towns as craftsmen and merchants. Life for the Kurdish nomads was seasonal, and many would come down from the mountains when it began to get cold, and essentially they would force Armenian peasants and townspeople to house them and feed them during the harsh winter months. They were able to do this largely due to the Ottoman millet system, which granted certain privileges to Muslims while denying those privileges to Christians. The most important of these privileges was the right to bear arms, a right reserved for Ottoman Muslims. So at the beginning of each winter, a significant number of Kurdish tribes would come out of the mountains and be housed and fed by Armenian communities, who were forced to live with this setup because, well, you know, they got guns. And while this was obviously a very unequal arrangement, for For a long time, the Kurds and the Armenians fell into a sort of tolerant equilibrium. Small-scale violence would break out from time to time, and some Kurds did operate as armed bandits. But for the most part, Kurds and Armenians coexisted for centuries in a manner that you would never really describe as harmonious, but which you could describe as relatively peaceful. But then, with the onset of the 19th century, this unequal equilibrium in eastern Anatolia would be severely disrupted. As we know all too well, there would be quite a lot of equilibriums being disrupted throughout 19th century Ottoman lands. But in eastern Anatolia specifically, this disruption of the old equilibrium would be caused by a couple of things. First, the efforts of Tanzimat reformers to centralize the imperial government, and second, the large-scale population exchanges that would occur as a result of the vicious series of wars fought between the Ottoman and Russian empires. We are going to talk more about the effects of these population exchanges next week. So today, I want to start with the effects of the Tanzimat. If you remember from Season 1, Episode 11, The Eastern Question, the Tanzimat Edict was first promulgated in 1839, largely in response to the decade-long crisis initiated by the Greek Revolution, and then later sharpened by the series of defeats the Sultan suffered at the hands of Muhammad Ali. Both of these humiliating losses were a result of insurrectionary elements within the empire itself. First, the rebellious Greeks of the Peloponnese, and later the rebellious Pasha down in Egypt. Such losses convinced Ottoman leaders that if they didn't quickly modernize and centralize their empire, then their empire might not be long for this world. And while Tanzimat reforms would take a long time to be fully implemented and many projects laid forever dormant in bureaucratic logjams, an area in which reform was enthusiastically carried out was in the effort to rationalize the imperial system by bringing the outer provinces under tighter centralized control. This centralization had two primary components. First, was replacing the local power brokers out in the empire's periphery with administrators more loyal to the imperial court in Constantinople. By placing loyal governors out on the edges of the empire, the Ottomans hoped to clamp down on the recent and very concerning trend of rebellious pashas. But along with these changes made at the top of provincial governments, there was another aspect of the empire's centralization that was slightly more vague, but possibly even more transformative in the long run. Influenced by Enlightenment ideals coming out of the West, Tanzimat leaders embarked on a kind of civilizing mission in which they sought to rein in the quote-unquote wild and unruly elements of their empire. In short, the imperial elites of Constantinople felt that in order for the empire to survive in an increasingly competitive world, they would need to, quote-unquote, civilize the parts of their empire that they felt were, well, uncivilized. This effort to civilize the empire's own subjects was a big part of the growing movement we've referred to as Ottomanism. Because historically, the term Ottoman had referred mainly to the elite class of imperial statesmen who ruled the empire. The Turkish term Osmanli literally just means the followers of Osman, founder of the empire. But in the 19th century, Ottoman leaders would try to broaden this term, formerly reserved for the elite, to include all of the Sultan's subjects. And as part of this project to turn everyone in the empire into Ottomans, the central authorities would send imperial agents out into the provinces with the goal of essentially forcing their elite imperial culture onto their insanely diverse population. The effort to Ottomanize the empire was met by fierce resistance at all levels of society. One of the empire's greatest strengths had always been its ability to incorporate previously rebellious elements into the imperial system by allowing powerful local leaders to govern their own affairs. Well, now the empire was sending bureaucratic elites from Constantinople to not only challenge the authorities of local governors, but also to force populations to change their traditional ways of life. Ways of life that had usually been practiced for, I don't know, thousands of years. and some of the fiercest resistance to Tanzimat centralization was witnessed in eastern Anatolia, mostly amongst the proud Kurdish chieftains. Ottomanism was a direct challenge to the dominant position of the Kurds in eastern Anatolia for several different reasons. First and foremost, Kurdish beys suddenly had to deal with things like imperial oversight and increased taxation and annoying paperwork. And then on top of this, the Ottomans would gradually try to forcibly settle the nomadic Kurdish tribes who were increasingly seen by imperial leaders as like the platonic ideal of these wild, unruly elements of the empire in need of some good old Ottoman civilization. And while many Kurds would begin to settle in towns and villages during this period, most Kurds would fiercely resist this process, and rebellions began to break out amongst Kurds with increasing regularity. And of course, this was the giant irony of the Tanzimat more generally, that as the empire's leaders sought to clamp down on insurrectionary elements by tightening their grip, they usually found that their peripheral subjects were like slippery bars of soap that would infuriatingly slip through their hands and then shoot violently across the shower. Now, the Armenians of eastern Anatolia, for their part, would actually view the arrival of the Tanzimat as an opportunity to try and secure their communities against the tyranny of the Kurdish tribal leaders. As Armenians heard more about the Tanzimat's promises to better protect the Christians of the empire and to make relations between the Millets more equal, Armenian leaders began to petition the government to follow through on their promises of reform. And Armenian elites in Constantinople would actually put together one of the very first constitutions in Ottoman history, as Tanzimat leaders allowed for the establishment of a little mini national assembly within the Armenian Millet. And it was through such channels that Armenian leaders would petition the imperial government for reform. Because while imperial centralization for the Kurds meant a loss of their historic privileges and possible forced settlement, for the Armenians, centralization meant the potential introduction of the rule of law to a land that had for centuries been ruled by the whims of armed tribal leaders and exploitative landlords. So, during the Tanzimat, it was Kurdish tribes that proved to be the most troublesome and rebellious elements within eastern Anatolia, while the Armenians mostly tried to operate within the new administrative system, hoping desperately that the imperial government would make good on their promises to better protect Christians. But Tanzimat leaders would sadly not follow through on their promises. And this was not necessarily a result of neglect or bad intentions, but rather it was just as often because the Ottomans did not have the necessary resources to carry out such sweeping reforms. Because saying that you will better protect the lives of your minority subjects is one thing. Actually carrying out those promises is something entirely different, and it usually requires, well, force. Powerful regional leaders are not going to give up their historic rights and privileges simply because you ask them to. Put bluntly, in order to actually provide real-life protection for the Armenians, the Ottomans would have to send in dudes with guns. No one understood this stark reality better than the Armenians themselves, who would constantly ask Ottoman officials to follow through on their promises. And that brings us back to the Congress of Berlin. Because after finding that their requests to Ottoman officials were falling on deaf ears, the Armenians decided to try a new approach, and a delegation of Armenian leaders would attend the Congress of Berlin in 1878 in order to appeal directly to the great powers to see if they might be able to help, since Ottoman reformers had done nothing of real substance for them. So, I want to end today's episode by introducing the leader of this delegation, because his personal transformation is somewhat symbolic of the radicalization that many Armenians would go through in the wake of the Congress of Berlin. So let's talk about Mekirtich Krimian of Van. As his name suggests, Mekirtich Krimian of Van was from Van, a city that was a major hub of Ottoman-Armenian life within the six provinces. And in the first few decades of his life, Krimian had traveled throughout the Ottoman Empire as a scholar and educator. And this experience as an itinerant teacher put him in contact with a lot of different Armenian communities, and it would shape his understanding of the broader issues facing his people more generally. Then when Crimean was in his 30s, he tragically lost his wife, mother, and daughter within a very short period of time. So with essentially no family left, Crimean decided to go all in with the Armenian church, and he became a celibate priest. And from this point on, Crimean would use his position in the church to tirelessly work on behalf of everyday Armenians. He started publishing houses, he opened schools, he founded charitable societies, and he became a fierce advocate for reform in Eastern Anatolia. These efforts gained him a lot of popularity amongst Armenian peasants, and he would affectionately be referred to as Crimean Hierarch, Hierarch meaning something like little father. In 1869, Father Crimean was elected as the Armenian Patriarch of Constantinople. And this was a really big deal, as it made Crimean the de facto leader of the entire Armenian population in the Ottoman Empire. Upon his election as Patriarch, Father Crimean would just keep doing what he had always done, and he would press the Ottoman authorities hard for reforms in Eastern Anatolia. And during his tenure from 1869 to 1873, the Ottomans were still in the thick of the Tanzimat, so Ottoman leaders were at least open to hearing new ideas. So Crimean put together a report that laid out what needed to happen. Reform the corrupt tax farming system, put an end to forced conversions to Islam, and most significantly, Crimean demanded that Kurdish tribesmen be disarmed and forced to settle. And then in order to implement these policies, Crimean suggested the creation of a rationalized police force that would include Armenians. As you might expect, Father Crimean was stepping way outside the normal sphere of official requests, and he rubbed not only Ottoman leaders the wrong way, but actually many Armenian elites as well. Because the affluent Armenians who lived in Constantinople did not have much of a connection with peasants living way far off in eastern Anatolia. They were pretty happy with the privileges they had built up over the years, and they were content with their little national assembly. They definitely didn't want this weird radical priest coming in and mucking it all up for them. So with all of these internal politics acting against him, Crimean was forced to resign in 1873. But then, Father Crimean would get another shot at winning reforms with the onset of the Russo-Turkish War. After the Russians won this war, their imperial army would occupy much of eastern Anatolia. And well, Crimean was a smart guy, and he knew a good opportunity when he saw it. So he put together a delegation and headed off to Berlin, hoping that he could use this Russian occupation to force the Ottomans into finally enacting their long-promised reforms. At the Congress of Berlin, Crimean and his fellow Armenians presented the great powers with the same list of demands that he had presented to the Ottomans a while back. But in addition to asking for a reform of the tax system and for the creation of a police force to limit Kurdish banditry, Crimean also threw out the idea of creating an autonomous Armenian polity that would encompass the six Armenian provinces. In this formulation, this autonomous Armenia would operate sort of like the Principality of Bulgaria, but with a lot more acceptance of the inherent diversity of the region, as Muslims would be invited to participate in government as well. And Crimean was very clear in stating that he did not wish to break away from the Ottomans. He was simply asking for more autonomy for the Armenians in governing their own affairs. Well, the establishment of an autonomous territory in the heartland of the Ottoman Empire was basically just out of the question. As we have mentioned, the creation of an autonomous Armenia was extremely complicated due to the fact that most areas in eastern Anatolia were actually majority Muslim, with large populations of Turks and Kurds. So even if a few of these regions had an Armenian ethnic majority, for the Ottomans, who thought primarily in terms of religious groups, these areas had very large populations of Muslims, and so to them, they were inseparable parts of the Ottoman imperial system. But through the efforts of Father Crimean and his cohort, the great power delegates were made aware of the plight of the Ottoman Armenians, And since the Armenians were primarily a Christian people, the Christian Europeans were sympathetic to their cause. And so an article was added to the Treaty of Berlin in which the great powers demanded that the Ottomans enact reforms to help the Armenians living in eastern Anatolia. But critically, the only enforcement mechanism for these reforms was a vague threat that the great powers would check in on the progress of the Ottomans. And if conditions were still terrible, the great powers would essentially have the right to intervene. So there was no commitment to disarming the Kurdish bandits or to establishing a police force who could actually ensure peaceful relations between Armenians and Kurds. Coming out of the Congress, Crimean and his colleagues knew that these were just empty promises. And the Armenian delegation had also had to sit there and watch as other Ottoman Christians were granted full independence with the creation of Serbia, Romania, and Montenegro, and the granting of autonomy to the Bulgarians. And from what Crimean could tell, the only difference between the Armenians and the Balkan Christians was that the Armenians had tried to win reforms by going through official channels, first through Crimean's proposal to Tanzimat leaders, and later through his proposal to the great powers at the Congress of Berlin. The Balkan Christians, on the other hand, had demanded their independence through armed uprisings. So, from this point on, Crimean would essentially transform into a radical revolutionary nationalist, and he would make full use of his prominence as a public figure, giving a series of sermons in which he would call on the Armenian people to rise up and fight and die for the cause of Armenian liberation. Or, as Crimean himself would famously put it, quote, "Armenia, in contrast with the Christian states of the Balkans, did not win autonomy from the Porte because no Armenian blood had been shed in the cause of freedom. There, where guns talk and swords make noise, what significance do appeals and petitions have?" And in this sermon, Crimean would famously use the metaphor of an iron ladle to compare the difference in strategy between the Balkan Christians and the Armenians, saying that at the Congress there had been a tasty dish of liberty available for all who could get it. But while the Balkan Christians had used an iron ladle to get their soup, the Armenians had used a flimsy paper spoon. So when the Armenians went to get their share of this tasty dish of liberty, their paper spoon had just disintegrated and left them empty-handed. The iron ladle speech is sometimes pointed to as signaling the beginning of the Armenian revolutionary movement. Many Armenian leaders would follow Crimean in his belief that they had been left out to dry by the great powers. And from this point on, more and more Armenians had decided that they would have to begin to take things into their own hands and to organize the defense of their people on their own terms. When Father Crimean returned home to Van, he would lend his support to these early movements for the liberation of Ottoman Armenians. And as the 1880s become the 1890s, these efforts to organize the self-defense of Armenian communities will become more and more important, because Sultan Abdulhamid will not follow through on the reforms demanded of him at the Congress of Berlin. And in fact, he will do the exact opposite, as he specifically directs his murderous paranoia against the Armenians of eastern Anatolia. Because when Abdulhamid discovers these early efforts amongst the Armenians to organize their own self-defense, the Sultan will not see these activities for what they actually were: an effort amongst a very small number of activists to simply defend their communities from arbitrary violence. Instead, the paranoid Sultan will think that he has uncovered a wide conspiratorial plot meant to prompt another great power intervention that would dismember his empire. So, in response to this perceived threat, the Sultan will go on to form his own personal cavalry of Kurdish tribesmen, whose specific purpose would be to shore up the Russian border and to crack down on this imagined network of Armenian revolutionaries. But as usual, it will be the Sultan's own repressive measures that will actually end up creating the fierce resistance to his rule that he was so desperately trying to stamp out. So, next week, the temperature will continue to rise in eastern Anatolia, as Armenians do what they can to defend their communities, and as the Sultan turns against them, forming his soon-to-be notorious fighting force that will bear his name, and come to be known simply as the Hamidiyeh.